Welcome back to California Burning, made possible with generous contributions from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. I'm Matt Fidler. Before the break, Stephen Pine was telling the story of Ed Pulaski and the catastrophic 1910 fires, and how he led his crew of firefighting foresters into a cave to protect them from burning when the big blow-up occurred. As the firewall passed over the entrance to the cave, Ed Pulaski and all his crew had passed out unconscious. The next morning, after the fire had passed and the smoke was thin enough to venture outside, most of his 45-person crew was alive, if not well.
Five men died. They passed out, suffocated or drowned in the muck at the base, but the rest were alive. Pulaski himself was badly injured, temporarily lost his eyesight, had lung damage, which would stay with him for many years, but the rest of the crew survived. And then later, he invents this tool, this combination axe and mattock, which we know today as a Pulaski.
The stories around the big blow-up, Ed Pulaski's and others, began to be used as political propaganda. Some used it to say you couldn't fight fire with just men, that it was a futile and dangerous gesture that sometimes made things worse. But the characters in these stories, like Ed Pulaski, became legends. They were real-life heroes. And it's hard to counter heroic narratives. By the time the fires of 1910 burned themselves out and were snuffed out by winter storms, 3.25 million acres of forests and hundreds of buildings in several towns had been burnt to a crisp, including a full third of the town of Wallace, Idaho, where the big blow-up occurred. The Forest Service lost 78 firefighters fighting this blaze, while not really even having a significant impact on it. But the legacy, not the legends, of the 1910 fires shaped our forest practices and policies for the next century. Many of the rangers stationed around Missoula, Montana, who fought the big blow-up, were to become subsequent chiefs of the forestry department and carry the scars of that fight with them, like a conquering general leading after the war.
William B. Greeley, who would replace Henry Gray, so he would become the third chief, was on the ground. Ferdinand Silcox was another one who was there, who would later become in the 1930s chief. And these guys are fighting the fires, but it's so burned into their memory, literally seared into their memory, that when they became chief, there's the notion that we have to fight fires, and it's going to be Ferdinand Silcox who will be the one that will announce what's called the 10 a.m. rule in the 1930s. The 10 a.m. rule. So here's how it goes. If you see smoke rising above the tree canopy, so this rule goes on to say, you have until 10 o'clock the next morning to put the fire out. In short, there has to be an immediate response.
And automatic, immediate fire suppression was the rule of the land. Now, if you think about it, this 10 a.m. rule is ridiculous. How can you make a rule that would sometimes demand the impossible? But this was war for them. Fighting fire is war. Hell, they first fought fire with real soldiers from the U.S. Army, and they saw fire as the enemy. And the act of fire suppression is like an occupying force. If there's an uprising, you squash it by putting it out before it has an opportunity to spread. Squash it for a generation, it will never come back, right? Well, no. That's not really how it works. But that's what these soldiers in this defining battle against fire thought was possible. So of course, the ones who came home with awards of bravery and courage from the great fires of 1910 became the future leaders and led based on the experience and lessons from the catastrophic 1910 fires. And talking about fire like it's war, it's a great way to approach Congress to fund your newly formed department, bringing the firefighting budget, like we said earlier, from $35,000 in 1908 to nearly $1 million in 1910.
Everything is here. Everything that we know today was all rehearsed, all brought together for the first time in 1910.
Because you couldn't have asked for a better way to expand the forestry department and legitimize a wildfire fighting force. This was no longer about land management. It was more like a battle cry.
Of the future chiefs of the Forest Service up through 1939, all of them were personally on the fire line in 1910. So this stayed with them. This was a kind of Valley Forge moment or Long March. That whole generation would look back on 1910 as a kind of marker, and they were determined it would never happen again on their watch.
The 1910 fires also affected Congress, who watched the budgets of fighting fires skyrocket. So in an attempt to get ahead of the problem, they passed the Weeks Act in 1911. This was to enable the purchase of land to protect valuable watersheds and to help with fire suppression.
The Weeks Act, so it also provided for a federal-state cooperative program in forestry, and this would be targeting particularly fire control. So this set up the mechanism to nationalize the Forest Service agenda.
Which is really well summed up with that 10 a.m. rule that we talked about earlier. As soon as you see smoke, jump on it and put out that fire as fast as possible, no matter what.
Well, the agenda was to remove fire as fully as possible from the landscape. This was academic forestry's argument. The more fire you could take out, the better everything would be. Part and parcel with, you know, eliminating predators or straightening out streams or all kinds of other things people were doing at the time that they thought was an improvement on nature, and it turned out to be misguided. So forestry was really ill-equipped to deal with fire, except as something to attack.
What did people that worked with fire, like the ranching community, for example, or the logging community that wanted to burn their slash, how did they react?
This was not accepted. It was really something that sort of the educated of the period thought was necessary. Instead, one of the interesting things about 1910 is that the same month as the big blow-up, August, we have a controversy which spills out in California, Northern California particularly, that became known as the light burning controversy. And there was a whole passel of people who decided that the Forest Service approach was wrong and that what we should be doing was to emulate the American Indian, lightly burning the landscape under benevolent conditions. And they argued that if we did that, continued that old tradition, we would not have fuels build up that would power very large fires. And if we didn't do it, we would have overgrown forests and they would be infested with insects and diseases, and we would have a mess.
And that's exactly where we are today.
That's right. So all this is not new. This was over a century ago. This was publicly debated, and it was a very hard fight for the Forest Service and foresters to eventually condemn it as a kind of anathema. And it took well over a decade to beat it down, but it keeps coming up. And eventually, as we look back on it, we wished they had taken the other choice.
Yeah, what were the, I mean, obviously they argued it successfully. Was it just because they were part of the federal government and they just had the authority, or did they make really convincing arguments?
Well, it was both, but part of it was that they could claim the nominal standing of science. This is what professional forestry and academic science in Europe announces, and this is what it teaches in universities. And this is the inherited wisdom. And it's not a bad understanding of fire if you're in temperate Europe. It's a pretty miserable understanding of fire if you live anyplace else.
And something very similar was also happening in Southern California during this early era of fire suppression. There were constant fires and firefights going on in national forests and the newly created national park system. But these firefights didn't go very well. They'd manage to suppress fires in one moment, and then the strong Santa Ana winds would pick up, causing the firefighters to run for their lives in situations that Professor Char Miller describes as being like the Keystone Cops, fumbling around clumsily because they really didn't know what they were doing.
Native Americans, the Tongan people who have been here for 5,000 years roughly, are watching this Keystone Cop-like fire management system. And in 1925, so sort of enraged, not only have they been cut off from their ancestral lands that are now locked inside these national forests and national parks, but they're sort of miffed that this new agency is trying to do stuff that they had managed for millennia. So they actually write a letter in 1925 to Calvin Coolidge, and suggest to the President of the United States that he actually turn the management of the San Bernardino and Angeles National Forest back to the Tongan people because, as they said, we had fire up there, We actually introduced fire into this landscape so that it would produce the kinds of goods and services that we needed. But we didn't have these 50 to 60 to 70,000 acre fires that ran out of control. We did it differently. Coolidge responds with a letter that I suspect was actually written in the Forest Service in the language of technology and technocratic expertise. And he says, we have the science, we have the fire management skills, don't worry, step aside, we'll take care of it. And that critique, when you couple it with Ehlers-Koch's argument later, dovetails into what we now know to be a much more reasonable and I think much more astute understanding of the relationship between fire and forest and human presence. But it was rejected because it was coming from native people or it was coming from this iconoclastic forester. And it wouldn't be until the 1970s and 1980s that it actually will get a fairer hearing inside the agency and within the American public.
Wow. So I'm still just a little bit confused about why they got it so wrong when they were all studying forestry. And that included parts of the Mediterranean that did experience fire in the landscape. Like, why did they get it so wrong when they were studying, they were looking into this?
These social institutions, whether it's the U.S. Forest Service or their analogs in the Mediterranean region, did not understand fire in ways that we now understand it, or at least the degree to which we understand it, is that they had a very different approach to what they were trying to do. If you perceive forests as economic assets, the sole purpose of which is to cut woods and put them into the economy, then the things that bother you, whether it's pests, beetles, fire, floods, those things have to be fought so that you can do the thing that you say you need to do, which is to get timber into the marketplace. So they're approaching it in a fairly monocausal way. There's an economic good, we have to protect it, and therefore we're going to protect it to the best of our ability. What they're not paying attention to as social institutions are the different voices that are starting to emerge in the South. There were Southern foresters inside the Forest Service, inside state agencies who were beginning to realize that, wait. These pineries in the South, they actually need fire to be good forests so that we can actually get the logs out. So let's let some of the timber burn because it's actually going to create healthy forests. That's not a concept that got taught in schools. It's not a concept that was put on the ground. And it's not a concept that was publicly palatable because fire was scary. And the 1910 fire scared the living life out of these foresters in the 1910. They were emotionally scarred by it. And so there's a kind of rigid response, a rigidity that goes into the curriculum and comes out with the next generations, plural, of foresters who adapt this notion that fire was bad.
Yeah, so it seems very psychological on kind of a twofold thing. Like first, as you said, fire is scary. And then it's maybe a little bit because the foresters that were logging didn't quite understand the systems they were logging in, that if something is against your own self-interest, it's difficult for the mind to take that argument seriously.
Yeah, and I think that's where psychology and sort of social structure merge. Fire is bad. Logging is good. So how do you rise in an organization like the Forest Service to become the chief? You log and you fight fire. And if you look at these Yale School foresters and then their successors, the way they rose through the ranks was to get out the cut, which means logging, and also to be one of these heroes that blasts his way into a fire, whether in the 1910 fires, the 1920 fires, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. That's how you got your stripes.
To be a war hero, like so many other politicians are, especially back then.
Yeah, so you're the hero. And one of the ways we sort of tap heroes and ask them to lead us is because they have actually led us. And that's how you became chief or associate chief or a regional forester, which manages the troops on the ground to produce certain kinds of goods, which meant fewer fires and more logs.
And And that works in the short term when there's still lots of old growth forest still intact that have larger trees to down. But when you're regrowing those forests, the trees won't grow as big and ripe for timber harvesting if there isn't fire or some sort of disruption to make room in the forest for those trees to grow big. So at first, the science was wrong, as Stephen Pine said earlier.
And the science eventually corrected itself. And in the 1960s and 70s, scientists are helping to lead arguments for reform in policy. But by then, the damage was done.
Because once the mindset has been made that fire is bad, and it certainly can be, I mean, especially as people left the farming life for growing cities, urban fires are devastating. And urban populations eventually start to lose their connection with the natural world. So instead of really solving the issues of wildfire, we tend to politicize them.
Fire is so graphic and so visceral in a way that people use it to animate some other agenda. So we end up not really talking about fire and how to deal with the fire problem. We end up saying, well, this is really a problem, but we need to reintroduce logging, or we need to get rid of environmental regulations, or we need to quit building houses in areas, or all these other things which are legitimate concerns, but they're all tangential to fire. And at some point, we just have to decide this is an issue that it's called fire, and we need to take solutions that actually address the fire issue, not trying to use fire to promote something else.
Thank you, Stephen Pine, for all your candor on these fire issues that we are currently facing. Also, huge thanks to Char Miller and James Lewis. On the next California Burning, we're going to go back further in time and learn about the native Californian way of managing this land. Join me as I talk with several Native Americans who are trying to bring back a culture of fire so that we can have fire on our terms instead of catastrophic wildfires when the conditions are worse.
Fire is a necessity, not only for the ecosystem, but also for the humans.
That's on the next California Burning, which is a co-production with North State Public Radio and was made possible by generous contributions from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Original music by Stephen LaRosa of Wonder Boy Audio. Thanks to our team, Sarah Bohannon, Greg McVicker, and Jill Fincher. I'm the creator and host, Matt Fidler. See you next time on California Burning.